Hello, and welcome to the Dr. Nyman Show. Today is Thursday, February 23rd, 2017. There's just been just some new developments in the H7N9. I think Dr. Nyman basically wanted to do a review and go over some of the gain-of-function studies and just some review of the science behind why H79 is a concern and some of the misconceptions out there. Okay, Dr. Nyman, take it away.
Okay, Ryan, it's good to kind of do this little update. As you mentioned, I was a little surprised as to what was floating around on the internet yesterday, and it's clear that some people had either forgot or never really understood why H7N9 is a concern, and so I thought I'd give a quick update on the high path and then kind of explain why H7N9 has been on very high and prominent on the radar screen ever since it, human cases were reported back in 2013. As far as the high path is concerned, China finally did submit an OIE report. That report came out yesterday. It acknowledged that these environmental samples that had been sequenced and had been made public on DSAD the day before really did come from live bird markets, which was the assumption. And it didn't really have a whole lot more than that. The OIE report did not give any locations. They just said that they were in Guangdong Province and that they had been identified in live bird markets and that those live bird markets that were positive had been closed. And then it was kind of curious. It said the start date was January 10th. And that was pretty bizarre because there have already been seven environmental sequences that have been made public. They were made public by WHO Beijing office, and WHO Beijing office who actually did the testing that was in the OIE report. So it was pretty clear what was being tested, and all of the samples that have been made public, all the sequences that have been made public, came from samples that were collected in 2016. The earliest samples were on November 7th, and the latest samples were on December 12th. So in spite of collecting these samples back in 2016, the OIE report said that the start date was 2017, January 10th, actually. And in fact, WHO had released two human sequences, and those two human sequences, one was from a recovered case, and the other one was one that was hospitalized at the time of collection. But both of those were prior to the start date. The recovered case actually involved the sequence was from a sample that was collected December 29th. And for the hospitalized case, it was a sample that was collected January 7th. So clearly, the outbreak began before January 10th because all of the samples that WHO had made public were from, all these sequences were from samples that were collected before the official start. And so that raised a little bit of concerns as to, the delay in actually releasing a OIE report, and B, the dates in the OIE report. And that was similar, I think we had mentioned before, but if we didn't, the hospitalized case was a 56-year-old male. And the list of Guangdong cases, the list of cases included Guangdong that was put out by the CHP in Hong Kong, just had one 56-year-old male from Guangdong province. And that location actually matched the location of the 56-year-old male sample from the Guangdong CDC. And so that made it look like it was probably from the same patient, and that the actual sequence itself, there were, you know, both organizations had released a sequence. The Guangdong CDC had released it on Saturday, and Beijing released it a couple of days later. And they were full sequences, so they had all 18 segments. Several of the gene segments actually were identical. A few of them differed by a single nucleotide. I think one of them differed by two nucleotides. And so it was pretty clear that these both came from the same patient. And the CDC sample was actually collected a week later. It was January 14th. And at that time, the patient had already died. And so the patient died on or before January 14th. And the media report describing the patient was the source of, was basically the second patient, was listed as being hospitalized, and that report came out a couple of days ago. So it was more than a month after the patient died, and the report, the emphasis of the report that said one patient had been recovered, the other was in the hospital, was that the HiPAP wasn't more pathogenic to humans than the LoPAP was. And frankly, the sequences indicated that the pathogenicity may very, very well be related to the additional adaptation change, which was E627K. That was in both of the samples of the patient that ended up dying. That was also in the sample from Taiwan, who is last reported in critical condition. And the patient that was discharged did not have E67K. So E67K, as you probably recall, affects the is temperature sensitive, and if there's a K at position 627, that's a male in adaptation, and the virus grows very well at a lower temperature. In contrast, if there's an E at that position, then it the optimal enzymatic activity is at 41 degrees centigrade, which corresponds to the body temperature of the bird. So the E is kind of adapted for efficient copying of genetic information at the body temperature of a bird, whereas the K is much more close. It's optimal actually at 33 degrees. Mammals have a temperature at 37, but in the upper respiratory tract in the winter when you're outside, the temperature is actually a little bit lower. And so it's kind of optimal for growing quickly in humans or other mammals in the winter. And flu is, you know, seasonal, and it does it has most of its activity in the winter. So in any event, that's kind of the quick update on the high path. And I was a little surprised when one of the people on Twitter had kind of downplayed the concerns regarding H7N9. And he tweeted that many changes were required for the virus to take hold. And I was kind of surprised at that, because the concern over H7N9 generally stems from the fact that there were gain-of-function studies that were done several years ago with H5N1. And gain of functions basically takes the virus and makes some changes to see if it picks up new functions. In this case, the new function was the ability of the virus to transmit from one ferret to a ferret in an adjacent cage. And And that was being done with H5N1, which is like H7N9, is a bird virus and has, you know, a limited ability to jump to a mammal like a ferret. And this is set up to see if you make some changes in the virus, whether those you can get the virus to actually do that jump, and either do that by making all the changes in the lab, or in the case of two of the three gain-of-function studies, to make some changes in the lab, put the virus in a ferret, passage in a ferret, so you grow it in one ferret, and then after a given period of time, you take the virus out of that ferret and put it into another ferret. And you keep going until you get a virus that all of a sudden has the ability to go from the infected ferret in cage one to the uninfected ferret in cage two without any contact between the ferrets. So the virus basically goes through the air and is able to be transmitted ferret to ferret. And then the second ferret that got infected by the first, you isolate the virus and you look at that virus and see what's different, and identify what changes allowed it to go from growing in the ferret but not being transmitted to actually gain the function of being able to transmit. And so, you know, scientifically, it's pretty straightforward. It's answer a key question because, you know, the issue was, well, how close is an avian virus like H5N1 or frankly, any avian influenza virus, how close are they to being able to make that jump from being a bird virus to being a human virus, or at least being a mammalian virus? And so the gain-of-function studies, you know, got a lot of attention. It turned into kind of a circus and a political event because there was concern that modifying the virus so it could infect and transmit in humans, or at least in ferrets, you know, which was in mammals, and that would be a short step going from ferret to human to human, that would pose two problems. One would be that if you published what changes allowed that to happen, then that some terrorist could get the virus, turn it into a bioweapon by making those changes and destroy the world. And the second concern was, well, if you make these changes in the lab and the virus escapes from the lab, then you'll have a virus that may have been far away from jumping from birds to human, and you made the changes that allowed that to happen, either by making them or selecting for them. And then it got out of the lab and it created, you know, a pandemic just because you were doing some experiments. And the problem with those concerns, I mean, you know, both of those are concerns, but the main problem is that there were three studies that were basically doing these gain-of-function experiments. And one of the studies had already been published. So the idea that you could restrict publication and basically impose rather draconian censorship so that the information wouldn't get out was kind of silly, since the information already was out from the one lab that had published it. And the information was kind of out from the second lab, because he had presented at a scientific meeting. And it became bizarre because it turns out that the changes they had introduced in the lab were the most widely known changes that had been studied for decades. And so it wasn't a secret as to what changes you might select. What was unknown at the time was whether that would work or not. And clearly it had worked, and clearly, you know, that's why he presented it, and that's why he submitted it for publication. You don't really get a whole lot of publications on experiments that fail and are negative. because there's lots of reasons why experiments don't work in science, and it might not necessarily have to do with, you know, what you did that didn't work. It's just, you know, how you did it. And so, you know, it was clear that it did work, and it was clear that everybody knew that it worked. So that was kind of the main conclusion. And the details were not that critical because, you know, it was known that he made three changes. He passed it in ferrets, and he got ferret-to-ferret transmission. So it wasn't a complex type of experiment. It was actually very straightforward, and the thing that was made it, you know, newsworthy was the fact that it worked. So the controversy was kind of silly. It was a little bit disheartening because the two journals that actually did impose a ban on the publication or a delay on the publication were Nature and Science, and those are the two premier scientific journals. And it was a little bit striking that the editors couldn't figure out that the details were not all that illuminating, and the experiments had already been done, so, you know, it wasn't like they didn't publish it, it would be safer than the experiments had already been done, the virus had already been created, and the virus had already transmitted from ferret to ferret. So the virus itself existed, regardless of whether it got published or not. And the information itself wasn't that exciting because, number one, the changes were not really all that novel. They were actually the changes that had been discussed for quite some time, and had actually been made in the lab for in vitro experiments. So there had already been experiments that were done in a test tube to show that making these changes in the virus and their receptor binding domain changed the receptor binding, and it would change from targeting birds to targeting mammals. And so it was already known that those changes could affect that specificity, and it was also known that those same changes at position 226 and 228 had been seen in two prior pandemics, that the 1957 pandemic was H2N2, and that happened because the H2 had picked up those two changes in position 226 and 228. And then there was another pandemic in 1968, which was H3N2. And the H3 had picked up the same changes. So it was clear that twice in not too distant past, the avian sequence in either H2 or H3 had changes at those two critical positions, 226 and 228. And that allowed that virus to switch from being a bird virus to being a human virus. And then, in fact, that those two changes allowed the virus to not only be a human virus, but to cause a pandemic. And in fact, caused pandemics twice, once in 1957 and once in 1968. So just to kind of go over the results and why it was so significant, is there were three different labs that were doing this. The one that did it first was actually the CDC in Atlanta. And, you know, the CDC is used to working with pathogenic viruses, and you know, these were all done in a BSL-3 lab to make sure the virus wasn't going to escape. And the CDC's experiment was, you know, a little bit, it wasn't quite as exciting because they did a lot of different changes, and they came up with a combination that was unlikely to happen in nature. And so even though they got it to work, it was like, well, you made so many changes that particular combination was unlikely to ever happen. And so how much did the unlikely changes contribute, and how much were was due to, you know, these two key changes at position 226, 228. I mean, what the CDC did is they took an H5 from a wild bird in Egypt, which was the clade 2.2, and they basically put it on a background from a clade 1 from Vietnam that had this E627K, and then they made the changes at position 226 and 228, and then for good measure, they basically changed the end, instead of using N1 for as an H5N1, they took Schumann N2, so from H3N2. So it basically had a Schumann N2. It was a mixture between a virus that's in Egypt with a virus that's in Vietnam. And they didn't actually have to do the passage. They basically put that into a ferret and put that ferret in a cage next to an unaffected ferret, and the virus keeps up. And so they published that. And in fact, it was so remarkable because, you know, they published it in a peer-reviewed journal. And usually if you got a subscription to the journal, you can read the article. If you don't have a subscription, you kind of just read the abstract that they kind of says it worked, but it doesn't necessarily give all the details as to what combinations were put together, or the types of details that you kind of want if you were a terrorist and you wanted to do this. And, you know, you could read it by just getting a subscription to the magazine, to the journal, or going to a library. But as it turned out, this particular article was fairly popular, and it had actually been uploaded to another site. And so you didn't even need a subscription to the journal, and anybody with internet access could read this entire article, which went through the details of exactly what was done, what those three different viruses were, and what the two changes were at 226 and 228, although they are the two changes that were in the pandemic. It was just Q226 changed to L. And G228 changed to S. So the two changes were not, you know, state secrets or any secret by any stretch of the imagination, that these were the two targets that have been discussed year after year. In fact, when new H5 sequences were identified, the first thing that most of the labs that did this said, well, it didn't have these changes that adapted to mammals, and they didn't actually say the changes, but these were the two changes they were talking about. They were talking about Q at position 226 changed into L, and D at position 228 changed into S. So this really wasn't a secret. So publishing the changes really wasn't going to reveal anything. The other change was this change in the PB2, which was E627K. It was well known that was first identified in the outbreak in 1997 in Hong Kong. Some of the human cases, in fact, had that change. And that was characterized. There were experiments done in mice, and it said, well, if you put that E627K, the virus grows better and it's more lethal in mice. So that seemed to be in a mammalian adaptation. And then experiments were done that actually showed this temperature dependence. And it showed that the virus, you know, the polymerase is a lot more active at 33 degrees than at 41 degrees. And it was known that seasonal flu did have E627K. So it wasn't a secret change, and B, it wasn't something that was perplexing. You know, how did this actually work? You know, it was pretty clear that it allowed the virus to grow better in humans or mammals, and in humans in particular. And so, therefore, the fact that if you had that change in the polymerase and you threw in the two changes in the in the H5, that you would increase the likelihood that this virus could actually go from one ferret to the other ferret. And that's what the paper showed. And it didn't do it in that elegant of a way because it had all these different combinations that were unlikely to occur in nature. But it was published, and it did say these were the three changes that they essentially started with. And it did work. They were able, with those three changes, they were able to get the virus to go from one ferret to a ferret, and then it takes it cage, so it passed through the air and led to the infection. And the two papers that got hung up in this delay in publication used two other viruses. They were both H5N1. And if you recall, the three main versions of the virus were clade 2.1, 2.2, and 2.3 as far as causing human cases. The one the CDC used was clade 2.2. The one that the group in the Netherlands actually was 2.1, which was a virus that was in Indonesia. And then the virus that was used in Wisconsin was really started with clade 1. So it was like three of the earliest viruses that were identified in 2003, 2004 were the ones that were used in these experiments. And what was remarkable is that they took three different viruses and they did three different ways to kind of do the same thing. The one of the Netherlands just took the virus out of Indonesia from the first human case, and they put those three changes in it. So it was pretty straightforward. You start with the virus, you change 226 and 228, and you change E627K in the polymerase gene. And then you put it into a ferret, and you keep passaging it into a ferret until it jumps to the ferret in the next cage. So it's not a complicated experiment, and it's not really novel changes. And the group in Wisconsin did another approach. They basically started with the with the clade 1, the virus that was from Vietnam, and they took the H5 out of that and just put it on a background of swine flu, of H1N1. So they took an H1N1 virus, they swapped out the H1 for H5, and then they put two changes in the H5. Instead of 226 and 228, they actually did 226 and 224, but they essentially got the same results. They passaged it in ferrets, and then eventually got it to jump. And the thing that was of interest was the two papers that basically were held up in Nature and Science. Both did the passage in ferret, and then they looked at the virus in the ferrets, and they both got the same functional change. There's a glycosylation site at position 158. And just as a quick review for the glycosylation site, it really has two requirements. First, it has to have an N, which is where the sugar residues go. And then two positions down, it's got to have an S or a T. And so that is the requirement to get the sugar on the end. And the amino acid in between can be anything except for a G. So essentially, if you've got NH, P, or S, that is a glycosylation site. And you can abolish that glycosylation site by either changing the N to anything and changing the S or T to anything other than an S or T. And that's actually what was found, passage in ferrets in Wisconsin led to that N being changed to a D. So that essentially, at position 158, abolished the the glycosylation site because there was no longer an end to attach the sugar to. And in the Netherlands, it basically did the other one. It took the T that was in position 160 and it changed it to an A. So since there wasn't a TRS, two positions down from the end, that also abolished the glycosylation site. And so that was kind of the fourth change. And it turned out the CDC didn't do that for their virus directly in the lab. They happened to pick a virus, which was the clade 2.2, that actually already had that change. So the virus they started with didn't require passage in the ferret because it already had the glycosylation site was already abolished. So the bottom line from these gain-of-function studies was you had three different labs. They started with three different viruses. They came up with these initial changes three different ways by either taking the N by changing, taking the H, and then doing different combinations to change some of the other genes, or actually just starting with H5N1 and making those three changes. And the virus they ended up with had all three of those changes, and they had had abolished the glycosylation site at position 158. So those were the four changes that seemed to be required to get H5N1 to go from being a bird virus that didn't go very well in mammals, including humans, to a mammalian virus that could jump from ferret to ferret with the assumption that it could probably also jump human to human. And so the information that these four changes did create a transmissible virus was kind of the take-home lesson from all three of those. And it could do that by a bunch of different pathways. And in fact, the two changes for Wisconsin weren't even 226 and 228, it was 226 and 224. And the H5 could be clade 1, or it could be clade 2.1, or it could be clade 2.2. That all of those worked, and they all kind of went through the same mechanism. And so the concern was that if you got those changes in an H5, if they had some or all of those changes that was floating around naturally, that those would be viruses to worry about. And it wouldn't necessarily just apply to H5, that if you had those same changes in another virus like H7, it would likely be the same. I mean, the serotypes really have to do with, how ferrets respond to the virus, and so they're classified, but I mean, they have the same functions, and they have the same, if they're going to infect humans, they have the same receptor binding requirements, and the enzyme, the E627K, is a mammalian adaptation, whether that PB2 is in an H5 virus or is in an H7 virus. It's an internal gene, and it's one of the genes that copies the genetic information. And so the gain-of-function studies that identified the key changes going from bird to mammal for H5 would be applicable to H7. And H7 had its own set of concerns. H7's kind of became a human concern after there was a major outbreak in the Netherlands in 2003. That involved H7N7. It was an H7 that had been circulating in Europe. It actually did become high path, and it decimated the poultry stocks in the Netherlands. And back then, there wasn't a good appreciation that a virus could actually infect humans through the eyes. I mean, it was kind of known the virus could cause conjunctivitis. And unfortunately, the colors that were basically culling the chickens that were infected with H7N7 had protective gear on, but they didn't have anything protecting their eyes. They weren't wearing any goggles, and they were just kind of picking up the dead birds and, you know, carefully disposing of them. And it turned out that about 89 of them got infected with H7N7. And most of them just had conjunctivitis, or they had flu-like symptoms, except one veterinarian who was involved with testing these chickens, got infected, got a serious illness, and actually died. And that death was the first bird flu death that was not H5. And it turned out that when they isolated the virus from that that veterinarian, he did actually have E67K. So the PP2 in that case had changed to the mammalian version. So he had a virus that could, you know, copy his genetic information pretty effectively at a lower temperature. And then some other tests that were done, which were antibody tests to see if others other than the 89 that were H7 PCR confirmed, whether they others might have been infected and therefore made H7 antibodies. There was an antibody test that was done to the colors and the context of the colors. And they had H7 antibodies in like 1,000 people. And that kind of indicated that this H7N7 not only could infect people that were culling birds that didn't have good eye protection, but that those people could actually transmit that H7N7 to contacts and not necessarily get a clinical disease, but get enough virus in there so that the infected people could generate some antibodies, and they could have detectable antibodies if they assayed their serum for H7 antibodies. So it was pretty clear that H7 did have the ability to transmit human to human, although you know, most of these cases were fairly mild, and a lot of them just involved conjunctivitis, and it was the one case that probably had a lot of exposure to the veterinarian that got, you know, fatally infected. And they did have E67K. That wasn't found in any of the other viruses. So he probably had a lot of virus and a lot of, that led to this enough selection pressure in this veterinarian that the E67K person became dominant and got the viral load up high enough so that he ended up dying from that. So that was kind of a red flag that H7 is a serotype that could be of concern. And that concern went up very dramatically in 2013 when China reported human H7N9 cases. And that became a major outbreak in 2013. And the virus was sequenced, and that raised a lot of alarm bells because there were quite a few, you know, there were literally hundreds of human cases. It was spread pretty widely in China. It was something that was hard to control because that was actually low path of H7N9. So in chickens, it didn't do much. The chickens were frequently asymptomatic, or maybe there was a reduction of egg production, temporary reduction, and then the chickens recovered. And so if you didn't really do the test, you really wouldn't know which birds were infected, especially if they were asymptomatic. And therefore, humans would get exposed to this H7N9 by handling birds that appeared to be healthy. handling and slaughtering and eating. And that was probably one of the main reasons that a lot of the human cases were affected, because they had no idea that the chickens or the ducks that they were in contact with had any avian disease, especially H7N9. So I was a little bit concerned because it was low pass and you couldn't tell which birds were affected by just looking at them. And was also concerned because even though it was low pass in birds, it was high pass in humans. That the fatality rate was around 30%, so 30% of the people that were lab confirmed of having H7N9 ended up dying. And so that was a very high case fatality rate. And then the alarm bells rang even louder when the virus was sequenced. And as I mentioned, the gain of function said there were four changes that you really had to worry about. The two receptor binding domain changes, E67K and the polymerase genes, and then the one that popped up after passage in ferrets, the abolition of the glycosylation site at position 158. These human cases, when tested, actually ended up having three out of those four changes. The glycosylation site was gone in both the human and the bird sequences. The E627K was largely confined to these human cases, but it was there at a very high frequency. So most of the human cases, at least the initial ones, and those were ones that were critically ill or dead for the most part, had E67K. And then probably the other alarming fact was position 226 had changed from Q to L, especially the human cases. And so it had one of the two receptor binding domain changes. It had EC67K, and it had lost the glycosylation site. And so anybody familiar with the gain of function studies and had actually looked at the sequences, and there were a lot of them, realized that this virus was of major concern because it was literally just one amino acid away of having all four of the changes that we're seeing in the H5 gain of function studies. And that's kind of where it is right now. The change at 228 in H7 has not been reported to date. It's been in China at least since 2013. And one of the positive results of the high pass is the high pass actually do not have the Q226L. They have lost the glycosylation site. They do have E67K, and they have this polybasic cleavage site. But the fact that it's circulating with the low pass that does have that change, these viruses can recombine, and you can't conceivably end up with a Q226L on a H7, this high pass. And exactly what that combination will do is a little bit unclear. And it hasn't been identified yet, but the number of sequences is rather low. There's only four human sequences so far. Like I said, it's likely that these came from three patients. And it does have a correlation with E67K, that the patient discharged did not have E67K. The patient that died and the patients in critical condition did have E67K. And then the other thing that stands out about the high path is it's actually Tamiflu resistant. So all four human cases is Tamiflu resistant. although none of the seven environmental sequences are chemically resistant. So this high path has its own set of concerns. One establishing resistance, one is the high frequency of E67K, and one is that of the three cases, one's dead, one's critical, and one's discharged. So it's got it's a fairly aggressive disease in a limited number of humans. That's kind of where it stands. So I want to kind of give this review to explain why the low path H7N9 is a major concern, and in fact, why the high path has got a new set of concerns. And although recombination, you could actually put both of those sets of concerns together. For the tamiflu resistance, you can reassort and just pick up the N9 and make the N9 along with the high path. So you could end up and recombination, you can pick up the Q226L. So you could take this low path virus that's raised a lot of alarm bells, has three of the four changes, and combine it with the high path and turn it into a virus that has the same changes in the low path, but also has a polybasic cleavage site in the H7 and is Tamiflu resistant in the N9. And, you might have some major problems even without the Z228S. As I mentioned, the one experiment that was done in Wisconsin didn't change position 228, they changed position 224. So all three of those experiments had 226, which is in China. And so if you got 226 and a couple of the other ones, the fourth one may not actually even have to be 228. It can be 224 because there will be another change of the receptor binding domain. And just two changes there is enough to start moving the virus more aggressively in humans and more human-to-human transmission. So that kind of wraps things up. H7N9, the low path raises some major alarm bells. The high path raises additional alarm bells, and the potential of combining those ingredients, the reassortment is actually the easiest. You can start with the low path and just pick up this Tamiflu resistance by putting the N9 in the high path into the N9 in the low path. And then you would have this virus that's got three out of the four cages and is Tamiflu resistant, which would be a concern as far as treating these cases. And so that's the update for today on the H7N9 situation in China.
Okay, well, thank you for the update. Listeners can always go to recombinomics.co for the latest information. It is up